Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Lung cancer is the most common worldwide malignancy, and it's the leading cause of cancer-related death. Not all people diagnosed with lung cancer smoke, and in fact, lung cancer is a disease that almost any of us can have. Today, most people who get lung cancer have either stopped smoking years earlier or have never smoked. So what are the current risk factors? What are the symptoms? And what are our treatment options? Our guests today are Dr. Jorge Gomez. He's the medical director of the thoracic oncology program at Mount Sinai Hospital. He's also assistant professor in the Department of Medicine for hematology and oncology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. His particular interest is targeted and immunotherapy with newer agents in clinical trials in patients with lung cancer. Also in this, and he's joining us by telephone from New York, and also in the studio is Marge Stone King, making her, I don't know how many, fourth or fifth or sixth appearance. She's the executive director of the Alaska Office of the American Lung Association. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you guys both taking the time. Dr. Gomez, let's start with the way I typically do with some basics. I'd like to understand in your mind, as a current cancer therapist, what is a cancer? What is the, how do you describe cancer to listening audience, a new patient who's been diagnosed?
So cancer is a group of cells that have started to grow abnormally. They've lost control of, over the you know, the factors that actually kill or let cells die. So they kind of become immortal in a sense, and they start growing and cause issues in one of two ways. They either grow locally and cause pressure, cause damage to nerves, bones, et cetera, or the cells can spread to other areas through the blood or other ways and cause growth of cancer in other areas like the brain, the bone, the liver, et cetera.
So the normal cells in our body are always turning over, dying. They don't normally spread around to the rest of the body and set up housekeeping somewhere else. They don't generate really new blood supply in different places. And those are some of the characteristics that you're implying that happens with a cancer cell for reasons we hope we will talk about a little bit later maybe.
Correct.
So well, let's talk about lung cancer in particular. Are there, obviously, it's a cancer that I guess originates in the lung, but there are several different cell types in the lung. So are there several different kinds of lung cancer?
Yes, there are actually several different types of cancer in the lung. The biggest way to differentiate them is by the type of cell. And so we have small cell carcinoma of the lung, which is a cancer that is almost 100% related to tobacco consumption. We have squamous carcinoma, which is another cancer that is mostly related to tobacco consumption, and adenocarcinoma, which is less related to tobacco consumption. Now, most patients with adenocarcinoma still have a history of smoking, but patients who have never smoked almost universally have adenocarcinoma.
All right, so that may help us understand as smoking, at least in the United States, is becoming less prevalent, why cancer epidemiology has changed a little bit. I guess you would, I'm anticipating the answer to this because I don't know it, is that the type of cell being involved in cancers is now different than it was, let's say, 30 or 40 years ago.
So over time, in the past, let's say about 40 years, the smoking-related cancers have begun to decrease, and the non-smoking-related cancers have increased, or adenocarcinoma. So the type of cancer, in terms of how often it appears, has changed somewhat. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And as a physician who deals with cancer all the time, you really almost think about these individual types of cancers as different diseases, and maybe even within the same cell line, it acts differently. It's like they're not exactly all coming from the same twin. They're not all identical twins, so to speak.
So the three types of lung cancer do behave somewhat differently. So if the small cell lung cancers are very aggressive, they grow very, very quickly. They tend to respond very well to chemotherapy, but they grow back very quickly after the chemotherapy is done. The adenocarcinoma and the squamous carcinoma behave somewhat similar, but adenocarcinoma in general tends to be a little bit less less aggressive almost. And the tumors that are very, very slow growing, that you can just kind of sit and watch for many, many years without changes, are almost all universally adenocarcinomas. Now, if you look at every patient with lung cancer, the truth is that every single lung cancer behaves somewhat differently. And so they're almost almost unique to the patient himself.
All right. I'm sure we're going to get back to that in some more detail when we start talking about targeted therapy, which may take advantage of these or has come about, sprung about because of the differences in these cells. But let's, if you don't mind, talk a little bit more about the incidence of lung cancer as a group and then the individual cells, if you can do that. Are we seeing more of it, or is it less? Is the incidence increasing or decreasing?
So in the United States, in absolute numbers, the number of lung cancers diagnosed every year continues to increase as the population increases. But the proportion of patients getting lung cancer has decreased. Again, especially for the smoking-related cancers. There still are a significant number of patients with smoking-related cancer because there are still a lot of people smoking in the United States, but those really have decreased.
What are the other risk factors? We've implied already that tobacco has a big impact on the types of lung cancers, and we're seeing a decrease in smoking-related lung cancers as smoking prevalence has decreased, but there is still a significant number of cancers in the lung, it sounds like. So what are other risk factors that we should make sure everyone's aware of?
So whenever we talk about risk factors, even though we've actually discussed the tobacco, we have to repeat that the number one cause of lung cancer is really smoking. Below that, or after smoking, we have several risk factors that are important. For example, asbestos exposure can increase the likelihood of having lung cancer. Radon exposure also increases the likelihood of having lung cancer. And environmental exposures like air pollution can increase the incidence of lung cancer. Now, genetics are kind of tricky. There are some families in the world that are predisposed to get lung cancer, but the truth is that there isn't really an inherited lung cancer. What has been shown is that there can be an inherited predisposition to get lung cancer. So, for example, you can inherit the predisposition to get lung cancer if you smoke, if you're exposed to tobacco, or you can inherit the predisposition to smoke. So there are genetic markers for addiction to nicotine. So people are much more likely to smoke and so more likely to get lung cancer.
Is there a common mechanism by which asbestos, radon, air pollution, and so forth work to increase the likelihood of an individual developing cancer?
So all of those environmental exposures work in a similar fashion. They don't work in the same way. It's not exactly the same mechanism, but it is a similar fashion, just producing mutations related to the toxins in all these products.
And with the exception of radon, you're talking about finer, ultrafine particles that can come from secondhand smoke or wood smoke or other forms of outdoor pollution, and can get even finer and more ultrafine when you talk about aerosols, like vape aerosols.
Yeah. I had written down, what about electronic cigarettes using vaporized nicotine and so forth? It's often, I suspect, very early in the use of these to begin to draw any conclusions. But what might you say as a lung cancer specialist about your concerns or worries and why about the use of electronic cigarettes?
I think the biggest problem about the electronic cigarettes is that we don't know what they cause in terms of cancer. We really, until now, don't have a firm grasp on whether or not these things increase the incidence of lung cancer. They seem to increase the incidence of having other types of lung disease, but lung cancer is not yet clear.
Then let me jump real quickly then to the most common symptoms. What's the way most patients with a lung cancer might present to a provider that leads to the diagnosis of lung cancer?
So one of the important things about lung cancer is that very often it doesn't present symptoms. It doesn't produce symptoms until it is very advanced. So many patients with early lung cancer, the curable lung cancer, don't have any symptoms at all. A small, let's say, 1-inch tumor in the lung may not produce symptoms at all in the majority of patients. When people do start to have symptoms, the first symptoms are usually respiratory. So cough, shortness of breath, coughing up blood, et cetera. Pneumonias, repeated pneumonias are often a sign of lung cancer. And the other symptoms are the symptoms of the cancer spreading to other areas. So when it goes to the bone, it can cause significant pain. When it goes to the liver, it can cause liver failure, it can cause pain in the abdomen. And when it goes to the brain, it can cause neurologic problems. So it can cause seizures, it can cause paralysis of an arm or a leg, it can cause confusion, et cetera.
So we've established that the absolute numbers of lung cancers are increasing in the United States because the population is, I think it's fair to say, aging and living longer. But the percentage of, or the relative rates, are decreasing, and probably to a significant degree because of the decrease in smoking. Where I'm trying to get with this is I wanted to replay some of the information I want listeners to be hearing, but I also wanted to get to, so now what is the outlook for patients with lung cancer compared to 15 or 20 years ago or even longer?
In terms of treatment?
Survival, I should have said.
So the survival of patients with lung cancer has changed a little bit in the past 20 years. We used to say 20 years ago that the survival of patients, of all patients diagnosed with lung cancer at 5 years, was about 15%. About 6 or 7 years ago, that went up to 16%, and now there are some people who are saying about 17%. And so that doesn't sound like a huge number, but that's a lot of people if you consider that about 230,000 a year are diagnosed in the United States.
And the vast majority of these are coming to treatment late because the symptoms are late.
That's correct. About 15 or 16% of patients are diagnosed with early curable cancer, and the rest have advanced late-stage incurable disease.
It raises a question in my mind, which I hadn't anticipated asking, but we have done a program on this before, and that is the usefulness, the recommendations for screening for lung cancer. What can the two of you say about that for me?
March, do you want to start?
Sure. So I think lung cancer screening has great potential to improve survival rates for lung cancer. We've only very recently in the last few years gotten any early detection for lung cancer, and it is for a narrow audience currently. So one of the things that we're doing at the Lung Association is through the Lung Force campaign, which I'll talk more about in a little bit, is trying to increase the amount of research going towards lung cancer to broaden the early detection. Mm-hmm. So currently, the guidelines are for 55 to 80-year-olds who have a 30-pack-year history of smoking, which means a pack a day for 30 years or two packs a day for 15 years, et cetera, and are currently still smoking or have quit within the last 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think the biggest issue is that the current screening guidelines are for a very defined population of patients, and that, right. that covers the people at highest risk
right.
or the people most likely to get lung cancer. But, you know, there are still people at high risk who have a smaller smoking history. The problem is we really haven't been able to prove that that screening can decrease the likelihood of dying from lung cancer in patients who are at lower risk. We know that it can decrease the likelihood of dying from lung cancer by 20% in patients who are at high risk.
And I think that there is a lot of work to do still to spread the message about the availability of lung cancer screening, both among providers
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and among the public.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of people who are eligible for it and fall within that defined population who haven't gotten it yet.
Mm-hmm. Or might be afraid of the cost.
So yeah, the cost is an issue, but the cost is a small issue. Now, there are many insurances, including Medicare, that will cover a screening CAT scan for patients who are at high risk.
Mm-hmm.
And if it has to be paid for, it usually is not very expensive. They're down now to about $300, which, again,
mm-hmm.
is a significant
mm-hmm.
amount of money. But for what it can give you, I think it's it's kind of cheap.
So
for peace of mind.
Yeah, for one of the... I don't want to say this inappropriately, but I think one of the advantages of the Accountable Care Act, the Obamacare, is that certain screening procedures that were proven to be effective now have to be covered by insurance companies. And so what you're saying is for individuals who fit the screening criteria, insurance, including Medicare, should pay for this. So
yeah.
that should not be, in that group of people, a problem other than just... maybe being scared of wanting to know, don't know that they should get screened, and so forth.
Right. So if you're 55 to 77 and you have Medicare,
mm-hmm.
And then
okay.
private insurance, okay. yeah. private insurance usually follows Medicare, so
okay.
likewise there, and you fit the rest of that criteria, then it will be covered.
Mm-hmm.
And then the questions we get is, what about... Yeah. If I lived with a smoker all those
right.
years, or what if
right.
I, you
right.
know, don't fit all those criteria? And that's where, mm-hmm. As Dr. Gomez was saying, it's about $300, and there are still
mm-hmm.
places you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can call 1-800-LUNG-USA to get a reference here in Alaska for where to go for lung cancer screening.
I think I want to take a second and also ask the question that always comes up, including in my own family when we discuss these things. Well, why don't we just screen everybody? We still, despite all the information that has come out on breast cancer, mammography, and prostate cancer, and changing guidelines, and people are still not understanding the algorithm that we go through to make sure we're using these things appropriately and getting into this, what's the risk, what's the benefit implications of screening. Dr. Gomez, you want to handle that one?
Sure. So screening everyone has several problems. First, there is a very significant cost to screening every person rather than screening every person at risk. You know, your reward is much smaller when you're screening people who are unlikely to have lung cancer. And so the way I look at it, from a kind of a policy and global perspective, which is one side, which is where you have to look at the cost and the benefit. And I look at it from the patient side, or from the doctor who's sitting in front of the patient, and the patient is saying, should I get screened even though I didn't smoke for 30 years? For those patients, the answer is yes. But on a global perspective, we kind of have to do it differently. Now, screening is associated with some negative side effects. There are patients in that are screened in centers that may not have a significant amount of experience with screening that can undergo procedures, procedures that have some small risk of complications unnecessarily. And so that's the biggest mm-hmm. Negative issue of screening,
mm-hmm.
that it may lead to unnecessary testing, which not only wastes resources, but also can place the patient's health at risk.
Right. There's also the issue that is a little bit maybe more subtle and harder to understand, and that is, at least for prostate cancer, and I think it's true for breast cancer, depending on your age and a number of factors, even though you find the breast cancer or the prostate cancer, you're not very likely to succumb to that problem, with death being the end point there. And that one gets me a little bit personally philosophically, because when you look at those studies, yeah, that makes sense, but there still may be some morbidity, some problems associated with the rest of your life before you are more likely to die of some other disease process. Dr. Gomez or Marge, you all must have be aware of that argument too, and you have any comments on that?
Sure. So there are some lung cancers that may not need to be treated. So there are very early lung cancers that we used to see occasionally that we kind of followed for a very long time because we weren't sure they were lung cancer, and they just kind of sat around for, you know, 2, 5, and then 10 years, and then suddenly at the end of 10 years grew a little bit, were biopsied, and turned out to be cancer. And so if you treat those cancers very early on, you know, you may not be benefiting the patient. But in lung cancer, that is less common than cancers like breast cancer or prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is a cancer where that happens very frequently.
Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that would resolve, one of the issues we have in understanding cancers, at least the way I think about it, I need to be corrected if I'm wrong, is we really need that technology, that science, that we can look at a cancer and predict whether it's going to be aggressive or not. And my understanding relates more to breast and prostate cancer because we spend more time talking about it on this program, but I suspect that's must be true of most cancers, is they're all individually different kinds of natural history with these. We've kind of implied they're differently already on a cellular level, each cancer. So is that true that we really need that technology, and what's the likelihood that you can foresee we'll come up with that ability?
Well, I think we learn more about cancer every day as our technology improves. But we already have some of those predictive models. You know, that's one of the reasons why we need much more screening. So we have probably the largest screening program in the world, which is based at Mount Sinai. It's an international program, so it's got about 65 institutions, but based at Mount Sinai, and have screened over 75,000 patients. And so all those scans are here. And our screening group has been able to look at these individual nodules or tumors and create algorithms to get a sense of which of these are going to progress quickly and which of these are going to, you know, just kind of sit around for a very long time and not grow. Now, this science is unfortunately very early in development, but our guys are pretty good at predicting what needs to be treated and what doesn't need to be treated.
And that's from a just a radiologic point of view, you're saying?
Correct.
Interesting. Dave, our engineer, has pointed out that I have gotten into this to an extensive amount without giving any contact information to our listeners, which occasionally happens when I get interested. So I'm going to take 1 second and remind listeners this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is lung cancer. My guests are Dr. Jorge Gomez, Medical Director of Thoracic Oncology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and Marge Stone King, the Executive Director of the Alaska American Lung Association of Alaska. If you have questions or comments, I apologize. Here are some numbers to call. 550-8433. 550-8433 is our local number. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. 888-353-5752. Marge, let's bring you in. You mentioned Lung Force. My understanding, this is Lung Force Month. What is Lung Force?
So Lung Force is a nationwide lung association campaign to do 3 things, raise awareness about lung cancer, raise funds to increase research funding for lung cancer, and that includes advocating at the federal level, but also raising our own research dollars for lung cancer. And then third, to destigmatize lung cancer. So you think about lung cancer kills more people each year than breast, colon, and prostate cancer. But people don't really know that because people don't really talk about that. And then oftentimes, what's the first question you get when you tell someone you have lung cancer? Mm-hmm. Did you smoke? Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to break that stigma as well, because no one deserves to get lung cancer and no one should be blamed for their lung cancer. And so a better way to approach that would be, I'm sorry to hear that. How can I help you on your journey? Or is there anything I can do? Just like you would respond to any other chronic disease, rather than asking that top of mind question, because it's really a hurtful question.
I would have missed the fact that I learned when I went to the Lung Force website, too, that it's the number one cancer killer in women. I would never have gotten that one.
Yeah, it's the number one cancer killer of men and women, actually. But the lung cancer death rate has actually fallen among men, while it's increased over 100% over the last 35 years among women, which is why we have a kind of special focus on women in the Lung Force campaign.
All right. We are approaching halfway through. We have a caller that just came on. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that caller, then we'll take our mid-program break. Kimberly, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, I was just wondering if there's a connection between allergy-induced asthma and lung cancer.
Okay.
More likely to develop cancer or less likely if they have allergy-induced asthma.
Do you have some specific worries yourself, or do you know if someone or heard something related to this?
Yeah, I'm an asthmatic, and actually I don't use my inhaler. I use coffee because I don't like inhaling anything.
All right. Well, let's ask Dr. Gomez. Dr. Gomez, any relationship that you know of between lung cancer and allergic asthma? And I guess we'll throw in including medications, since Kimberly's a little bit worried, it sounds like, about her medications as well.
Right. Although in other cancers, there is a clear effect of inflammation on the incidence of cancer.
Right.
In lung cancer, that has not been so clear in terms of the mm-hmm. allergic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously in patients with COPD, there is a higher tendency to get lung cancer. But in allergies, that's not completely clear.
Mm-hmm. And in a simplified way of explaining that, inflammation is a response of the body to injury. So it may be that recurrent injury leading to recurrent inflammation, cell turnover, got to reproduce those cells, got to do all our genetics, got to reproduce the DNA. That may lead to errors that might increase the risk of cancer. Is that kind of the simple story, or is it more complex than that? Well, it has
to
be.
No, I think that's the best way to put it, sure.
Okay. So, Kimberly, does that help you?
Yeah, that's good. Cool. Thank you.
And I don't know of any particular increased risk due to the medications either.
Correct.
And there's risks and benefits to caffeine. There's risks and benefits to albuterol. And from an inflammation standpoint, those inhaled steroids that everybody doesn't like to take are pretty doggone safe. And keeping inflammation under control is still pretty critical for lung health otherwise. So keep that in mind. All right, so let's take our break. I want to remind listeners one more time, our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, then we'll continue our discussion on lung cancer with Dr. Jorge Gomez and Marge Stone King. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is lung cancer, and our guests are Dr. Jorge Gomez, Medical Director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at Mount Sinai Hospital. He's also an assistant professor in the of oncology and hematology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Also in the studio with me is Marge Stoneking. She's the executive director of the Alaska American Lung Association of Alaska. You can email questions to us during the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that this program does repeat with a taped recording between 8 and 9 Monday evening. So if you're listening at that time, we won't be here to answer your questions. You've got to call in now or email now if you would like us to help you answer the questions. Jim, you're on line one. Let's take your question. What can we do for you?
Yes, I've been diagnosed with COPD from mechanical damage in an auto accident, rollover accident on the Seward Highway. Where I ended up with a collapsed lung, broken ribs, and associated other damages. But I ran Mount Marathon 3 years in a row after that, not realizing that I only had half the function of my diaphragm because of that accident. And I've done a lot of running. So I'm just curious how that impacts my possibility of lung cancer. And I'm 70 now.
How about other associations? Any work exposures that you're worried about? Did you smoke, things like that?
I did briefly smoke in my early life in my 20s, and then I quit. Mm-hmm. And I've been exposed to asbestos out working on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. They had a lot of asbestos out there that they had to replace with a non-asbestos fiber, but I have been exposed to asbestos.
Okay. All right. All right. I'm just anticipating some possible questions. Dr. Gomez may have others. You want to address these questions, Dr. Gomez?
Well, yeah. So I think that, you know, the concern about your accident-related injury, thankfully, is not that big. So there is no clear association between lung cancer and that type of chronic lung disease. It's really the tobacco-related chronic lung disease that has a high risk of developing lung cancer.
So the brief time that I did smoke, is that how's that impacted?
Well, you know, any amount of smoking is bad, but in general, the incidence of lung cancer is associated with higher rates of smoking. So people who smoke more than or a pack a day for more than 15 or 20 years are the ones that are more likely to get lung cancer. And obviously, the more you smoke, the higher your risk. So if you smoked for a short amount of time, the best thing that you can do is really never smoke again. And your risk of developing lung cancer is always slightly higher than patients who have never smoked, but really is associated to the amount that you smoked. And it sounds like that's pretty low.
Yeah, it was brief and low.
And, of course, there's no guarantees, so every individual responds differently.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Bobby, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. I'm not proud of the beginning of this, but I started smoking when I was 10. That was 1944. And in 1974, I stopped smoking. This year, I had a chest x-ray, and the doctor said that my lungs were absolutely clean. And I'm wondering if there's something else I should do now.
So, yeah, good question. Is a chest x-ray significant enough, and does she meet any of the requirements here that she might benefit from a better cancer screen?
So the first thing, chest x-ray has never really been shown to be an effective screening tool for lung cancer. The big clinical trial that had over 50,000 patients that compared chest x-ray to CAT scan was the one that actually proved that there is a benefit in terms of dying from lung cancer with CAT scan. And so while chest x-ray is good at, you know, looking to see if there are any big pneumonias or large tumors, it's not a great tool for finding lung cancer.
why I called.
You don't quite fit the criteria for high risk just because of the amount of time that has passed since you stopped smoking. But, you know, again, it may be something worth exploring because you did smoke for a significant amount of time. It's yes. still something worth exploring, a CAT scan.
All right. And anything other than a CAT scan?
So the only thing that I say and the only thing that really is effective is not smoking again.
Oh, yeah. I you know, since 1974, I haven't even thought of it.
Good for you.
So, okay. Now, so is it permissible for me to call my family doctor and request a CAT scan?
Of course.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I would just say that you heard the program, and you might want to look and see, and you understand you don't exactly fit all the criteria that indicate that that this CAT scan may be paid for, but you would like to explore the possibility of doing a CAT scan anyway, just to help you feel more comfortable about everything because of your risk.
Yeah.
And to double check the criteria for screening, for those that are listening, you can go to lungusa.org/LC screening, and it'll tell you whether or not you fit and tell you a little bit more about it.
All right. May I have that address again, please?
lungusa.org.
Okay. Wait a minute. Just a minute. Lungusa. Okay.
.org.
.org. Yes.
/LC, as in lung cancer, screening.
LC dot screening.
Not dot.
Just LC screening.
Yeah.
What's that?
Just LC screening. No dot with LC.
I'm sorry. I made you too. I'm a little confused. Okay. So I got /LC.
Screening.
And then what?
Screening. The word screening.
Screening. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. Have a good day, Bobby. Heather, you're on line one.
Thank you very much. You've covered this somewhat, but I'd like further explanation. I do not smoke. I never have. And I hate smoking because it's killed a couple of people I love. I was raised in a family of smokers, and I was surrounded by smokers, and my whole environment was full of smoke until I was, 20 years old or more. I have never suffered, I think, much of what is lung damage, but I've certainly been around smokers until I simply wouldn't anymore. What is the danger level and what is the susceptibility, especially, and I'm especially looking for what's the susceptibility of children, young children in a smoke environment? And thank you very much for the work you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. So the issue is, what's the risk of secondhand smoke? Is there a timing? Is it worse if you have the exposure early in life? Have we quantified it? How good is the science on association with secondhand smoke and cancer in particular?
So the science behind lung cancer and secondhand smoke is good in so much that it tells us that secondhand smoke can increase the likelihood of having cancer. So that's clear. What isn't clear is that secondhand smoke is difficult to quantify. You know, it's easy to say, I smoked a pack a day for 10 years, but it's very difficult to know how much exposure you had to secondhand smoke, whether the windows were open, whether all the windows were closed, how much smoking was going on during the day through the house.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, it does increase the risk. Earlier is worse, so the earlier you have exposure, the worse it is. So people should really never smoke around children. And the amount of smoking that went around, so the amount of exposure, the one that's difficult to quantify, is also obviously very important.
All right. I would like to move ahead under treatment just a little bit. I know there's a caller holding on, has a question that sounds like it has a comment about radon, but I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about treatment, and so I'm going to ask that listener to hold where they are. This is Line 1, your health connection. We will take some other calls if we have time. Our local number, 550-8433, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So with a broad swath, what are the treatment options for lung cancer, understanding that it really depends on the individual and their disease?
So for early stage disease, the best treatment is obviously surgery. There are some patients where surgery doesn't play a role, and chemotherapy and radiation can, in patients with early disease, also cure cancer. So the goal of treatment in early disease is to cure the disease. But as I mentioned before, the vast majority of patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer have advanced disease, and advanced disease is no longer curable. The goal of treatment is to prolong life and to improve quality of life, and both of those are very important. And we do that by several different methods today. And you know, the number of treatments are increasing every year, fortunately. But broadly, those are chemotherapy, and those are the standard chemotherapies that we have used for all cancers for many years. The second is targeted therapies, and targeted therapies are for certain populations of patients. So certain patients with lung cancer have mutations or changes in their cells that make them very sensitive to new targeted drugs. And the third broad group of treatments is immunotherapy. And immunotherapies are now accepted treatments for lung cancer. They are approved by the FDA as a first and second and third treatment for lung cancer.
I want to back up and define advanced disease. That caught me by surprise, and I am assuming other listeners. So early non-advanced lung cancer, you stated, was curable. Advanced disease is not curable. So let's define more clearly what we mean by advanced disease.
So in all cancers, we have a what's called a staging system, and that's really just a way to figure out how far the tumor has gone from the original site. And we divide lung cancer into four different stages. And in a general sense, stage one is a very small tumor that we can just operate and take out. Stage two is a small tumor or a little bit of a larger tumor that has spread to the lymph nodes nearby, near inside the lung, but near the tumor. Stage three is a tumor that has gone to the lymph nodes outside of the lung, between the lungs and the chest. And stage four is a disease that has spread outside of the chest,
okay,
or has gone to the lining of the lung. And so early or early and locally advanced disease are stages one, two, and three, where we can still cure patients.
Okay.
And anything that has gone outside of the lung or into the lining of the lung becomes incurable. And again, that's about 85% of patients.
Incurable in the sense that no one has proven that once you get lung cancer outside of the lung, that with these metastases and so forth, that we're able to completely remove all the cancer.
Correct.
Okay.
Although, again, incurable is not an absolute term. There are patients with advanced disease that have been cured.
Right.
But those are patients, for example, who have been operated for early disease. So one small tumor in the lung, it's taken out. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, they develop a lesion, and which is a metastasis from the same original tumor, in, for example, the brain. And we go in, operate the tumor in the brain, and in some patients, the disease never comes back. Mm-hmm. So there are some patients with advanced disease outside of the lung who can be cured, but the vast majority cannot.
To save time a little bit, I was going to talk about differences in a little bit more detail about how cancer cells differ from other cells and how individual different kinds of cancer may even be different in the same individual, perhaps even. But what I would like to do is kind of get into this idea of targeted therapy and what allows us to now have targeted therapy. Who is that for? What are we talking about exactly? Could you help us understand that idea in a little bit more depth?
Of course. So about 20% of patients with lung cancer have a different type of lung cancer. That cancer is different in that the cells have mutations in their DNA or changes in their DNA that helped produce that cancer. We call those driver mutations, and we call them drivers because they're, in fact, you know, driving this bus of cancer. Patients with those mutations tend to be patients who are non-smokers or have never smoked. It can happen in men and women, but it is more common in women. And there are certain populations, like the Asian population, that has a higher incidence of this type of mutant cancer. Now, anybody can have a mutant cancer, including somebody who smokes. But it may be that that cancer, in spite of the fact that that person smoked, is a non-tobacco-related cancer. And those cancers are different because since they don't have the complex chemical exposures that patients with tobacco exposure have, they may have just a single mutation driving the whole cancer. Mm. And so if you can turn that off by inhibiting it with a drug, so getting a targeted therapy that targets that little spot, you may be able to turn off the cancer, and in fact, that can happen.
So my idea of cancer is that there are multiple DNA mutations, changes over time that lead to the ability of a cell to do all the things we described previously, immortality, metastasis, and so forth. And so that's why it may take time for cancers to develop all of the different mutations that lead to this. But what I'm hearing you say is there's also a subgroup of at least lung cancers where there's a single mutation that's driving everything. And if that can be recognized, we now have the therapeutic armamentarium to turn off or to affect that mutation in a beneficial way.
That's correct. And those tumors, since most of the cells are very similar and they have the same mutation, when you give one of these targeted therapies, you have the ability in many patients to just almost make the tumor disappear. Wow. So I've seen tumors that are, you know, six inches across, just almost melt away in a week, in 2 weeks, which is something that's very unusual for lung cancer. So this isn't something that's typical for patients with lung cancer.
All right. And so that's a pretty big group, 1 in 5, 20%, and they're people who usually don't have a big exposure to smoking. They may be more likely to be women. They are non-smokers, you said, and there may be certain cultural risk factors associated with these individuals.
And correct.
So can you identify, do you have a good feeling right from the get-go, this patient presents? Can somebody in radiology say, hey, this looks like one of these, where are you just start screening everybody that comes in with lung cancer for these kinds of mutations?
Well, we do have a way to clinically identify them. So before we do any testing, and those criteria that I mentioned, so women, Asian, never smokers are much more likely to have that type of cancer. So if you're looking at the overall population of lung cancer, it's about 20%. If you start cutting down the population, so the vast majority of these patients have adenocarcinoma-type lung cancer.
Okay.
And so if you look at just the adenocarcinomas, then the percentage starts to increase. Yeah. And if you look at the adenocarcinoma never smokers, the percentages are even higher. So it's closer to 40 or 50% of patients who actually have these mutations. Mm-hmm. So you can identify some of them, but the best way to identify them is really to do the testing of the tumor itself.
Yeah, so then you take some cells from a biopsy and you perform this magic in the lab and you say, hey, yeah, this person has this genetic mutation and we think we can affect that beneficial.
That's correct.
All right. Broadly, paint this picture also again for this immunotherapy. These are two. The reason I want to talk about this, to me, these are big game changers in cancer therapy across the board. And you can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but nevertheless, tell me about immunotherapy as well.
Oh, I agree. Both of these things have been huge changes in lung cancer, and they've been very big because there had never really been any big changes in the lung cancer treatment area. And so we didn't have these magical, almost magical pills that could make a cancer disappear very quickly. The negative side of that is that it really is a defined segment of the population of patients with lung cancer. So most patients with lung cancer do not benefit from targeted therapy. When we look at immunotherapy, the populations are less clear, although there is a population that seems to have a more significant benefit. So immunotherapies that we use today that are approved by the FDA and that we know work are what we call checkpoint inhibitors. The immune system is very smart. You know, the immune system knows what to attack, but it has a lot of controls. So there are brakes, if you will, in a car, there are brakes to stop the immune system from attacking the body. So you can attack a tumor, but you can also attack the body and cause what you would call autoimmune problems. So the immune system attacking your own body cells. And there are many examples of autoimmune diseases like lupus, like rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera. Those are diseases where the immune system attacks the body. So those breaks prevent these things, but they also prevent some of the attacks against things that are not so good. So they can also prevent the attacks to cancer. When we inhibit these breaks, we give drugs. These are antibodies created in the lab that can inhibit these breaks. We kind of let the immune system go. We let the immune cells, the lymphocytes, attack tumor, attack infection, et cetera. And these drugs have actually been very helpful. And so in patients with advanced disease, which is right now where we're using these drugs, can improve survival. It can make patients live longer. And on average, it's about 3 months longer, but that doesn't really mean that everybody lives 3 months longer. There are patients who live much, much longer, and there are patients who do not benefit from immunotherapies. In many of the earlier studies, the patients who appear to benefit from immunotherapy are the other group of patients, the tobacco-related malignancies. And so the ones who have multiple mutations, one on top of the other, that have taken a long time to develop and to create this cancer. So this is not quite targeting the smokers, but seems to work better in patients who have those multiple mutation cancers.
Okay. We are in about our last 5 minutes. I have a couple of callers still. I want to at least take one of them, see where this, how long it takes us. Debbie, you're on line one, and just remember, we just have a couple of minutes. What can we do for you?
Sure. I am a Hodgkin's disease survivor. I went through chest wall radiation therapy in the early 80s. And so, of course, lung cancer is a huge secondary cancer risk for me. My question for clarification is, for diagnostic purposes, you said CAT scans or chest x-rays were not a good way to diagnose lung cancer, and CAT scans were better. My pulmonary doctor is telling me otherwise. What should I do?
So what is your pulmonary doctor telling you?
That a chest x-ray is the best way to diagnose to see if I have lung cancer. And I have a lot of scarring. Mm-hmm. I have a pulmonary, I have an effusion on my lower lung. Mm-hmm. I have restrictive pulmonary mm-hmm. fibrosis.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yep.
So it's very likely that you have a chest x-ray that's abnormal.
Yes. It's highly likely.
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, there have been many clinical trials in thousands and thousands of patients, I mean up to 50,000 patient trials, looking at x-ray compared to nothing, and x-rays did not show any significant benefit. And these trials were done in the 1900s. And CAT scan compared to x-ray in this very large trial that was done by the NIH was able to diagnose lung cancer significantly better than X-ray. Now, the downside of CAT scan is really the exposure to radiation. But the amount of radiation exposure with these low-dose CAT scans that are being used for screening is extremely low. And they are, as far as we can tell, with many years of follow-up, very safe. Now, in someone who has a higher risk, and I would consider you, again, in the high-risk category, I think CAT scan would be ideal. You know, I have treated many patients who have had lung cancer caused by radiation after Hodgkin's disease. Again, it's not as common. Most people will not develop lung cancer, so this does not mean that you're going to get lung cancer. But it is important to look periodically, and so CAT scan, I think, is ideal.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Is a prior history of lung radiation for cancers like Hodgkin's disease a criteria for getting lung cancer screening with CTs? I don't remember that being discussed.
The truth is, I don't remember either. Marge?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's not included in the recommendations, mm-hmm. but again, that doesn't mean... Yeah. That you can't have it.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean the physician can't appeal to a payer to have that covered, whether it's covered or not. I mean, it seems like a very reasonable. Let me ask Dr. Gomez. It seems to me it'd be a very reasonable thing to do, and it sounds like you just recommended that would be a good idea. Would you agree?
I think, on a personal note, I think it would be a very good idea, and I think that payers are unlikely to turn that down based on the previous cancer.
Right. All right. I'm going to have to apologize to people who are holding on. We're not going to be able to get there. I want to have Marge at least have some final comments. What do you want people to take away from the program? And if we have time today, I'll ask Dr. Gomez the same thing.
So lungforce.org is the campaign website for LungForce. You can learn much more about the campaign. You can share your personal story to help raise awareness around lung cancer. Ask your doctor or go to the Lung Association website to find out if you meet the screening criteria. And try not to stigmatize if you encounter people in your life who are diagnosed with lung cancer. Lastly, we have a lung cancer, lung force awareness night at the Alaska Aces on Friday, November 25th, if you want to help us raise awareness and funds. And you can find out more on the American Lung Association in Alaska Facebook page.
All right. Thanks to both of you. Dr. Gomez, thanks very much. It's been very educational for me, and I'm sure our listeners have benefited. I really appreciate your taking the time.
My pleasure.
Have a good day. Marge, thanks again for taking the time. It's been a pleasure again.
Thank you for having me.
If you all listen, if the listeners would like to continue the discussion on lung cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook to do that. You can find the link at www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also can find our archives and listen to this program again if you would so wish to. Line 1 will take a break next week, and our next program will be hosted by Prentice Pemberton on November 28th. And why not join that discussion on a behavioral health topic? It'll be at 2 p.m. right here on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was today's audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.